Frank, good morning.
I have two homeworks here.
Okay. What actually went wrong last time when I tried to display the computer is that the app had updated that you can select some key configuration which was used. And default did not work. One has to select explicitly US keyboard. So that's why that didn't work. Anyhow, probably, unless you really want to see it, I will not do it live. What I have done is I've listed a few examples. So this is the new homework. I put a few, on starting on the bottom of the first page and then going to the next page, a few examples of, for example, how to create a finitely presented grouping gap. Where one has to be slightly careful is the letters between the free group and the elements of the finitely presented groups also are printed as letters but are different objects. Mm-hmm. And there is this function assign generator variables. If you want to have A and B, you could assign access to G.1 and G.2, but that's the easiest way to have A and B assigned to these. And then you can, for example, create a subgroup and calculate the index. You can get the coset table. Abelian invariance, that's something I just mentioned very briefly, takes relators for a presentation and writes them as, well, I mean, you had we did this last year in 567, but you might not have seen the method. You write them in abelianized form. You take the exponents, write them as rows in a matrix, and then you bring the matrix into elementary divisor normal form. And the entries on the diagonal will give you the structure as an abelian group. This is basically one way how you can prove the theorem that every finitely generated abelian group is a direct product of cyclic groups. That's the constructive proof for that. And you can do this, so that would give you the largest abelian quotient. Well, in this example, it was trivial, but for example, if you had 2, 3, 3, it would be a Z6 cross Z3 or Z2 cross Z3 cross Z3. And I mentioned this low index algorithm, which finds by just trying out all possibilities, trying them in a clever way, because otherwise it gets even more horrible than it is. Subgroups up to a certain index. I hope that starting it and so on is reasonably easy enough, and that by now there are sufficiently many people around in the department who know how to start it, or so. If you have problems, send me an email. Otherwise, yes, these are more problems, and they are more because, and I said April 21, probably the Thursday is better, so if there are questions, you can still ask in class. So let's move it from April 21st to the 23rd. This is more because there won't be lecture the next two weeks. So the first set of problems are basically problems which can be done just by hand, which don't need any computers. So the first one is an obvious question: is a group finite? And there are a couple of ways how one can show this. One is you find an infinite quotient, and there it's not hard to find, even if you just take 2x2 matrices, to find matrices which are images, so two matrices of order 2, basically, where the product has infinite order. That's all you need.
Is that typically how you go about proving these things are infinite? I mean, because you can kind of see that there's very...
There are a couple of things. There are basically... I'll say more about this just a bit later.
Okay.
Yeah. The next one is I mentioned that if you permute a relator cyclically, that is conjugation with its first letter, or if you have an arbitrary word. And so one can look at this the case of cyclically reduced, because that basically just would replace a relator with a conjugate, and this is some property for being for cyclically that for two words being conjugate in the free group. That's a relatively easy combinatorial argument. Problem 17 is just a very basic example of the process which one can do to go from one presentation to another. So what you can do is, if you have a presentation in generators, if you want to add a further generator, you basically can add the further generator and a relator which expresses that generator in the old in the generators you had before. Then clearly that is not giving you anything new. And vice versa, you can throw... if you then can identify from this word how to express one of the other generators in terms of your of including the new one, you can throw it out. So that's basically what you will do in part B and C. And part D is, if you have a group, S4 happens to be a semi-direct product of C2 square with S3, you can take a presentation for S3, you can take a presentation for C2 square. I mean, C2 square is just two generators, A and B. A square is trivial, B square is trivial, and they commute. And now you just describe how you want the action to be. And then it's not hard to see that this gives you a semi-direct product. 18, yeah, there has already a hint that is... not hard. 19, I don't remember whether I gave this last year in 567 as a homework problem. So this is in some way really just a toy problem. You pick the free group on 26 letters, and you say you create as relations if two words are pronounced the same in English. So, for example, C, the water body, is pronounced, or at least I pronounce it the same as C, I see something. So from that you could, you would have, C is equal to C, because you can kind of cancel S and E, you see that E would have to be the same as A. Okay, and the question is, what can you do with this group? What is the structure of this group? Allegedly, when Serre brought this problem up the first time, it allegedly said, well, for English and French, this group will be trivial, but for German, it will be free of a very high rank. and actually, it turns out that the group is trivial in all three of these cases. There is a very funny article where they actually prove this, which I've cited here. It's a two-part article. It's written in French and English. They prove the result for English in written in French. They prove the result for French written in English. Probably next time I'll try to remember to bring it. It's really, or maybe it's just 3 pages, a really funny article. So that is really just as a toy problem. 20 is to do a coset enumeration. I want A and I guess I want A and B conjugate by A. Yeah, I mean, this is just to do one example of a coset enumeration. The presentation looks more messy, but that's in part to actually make it easier, that you will get a lot of relations quickly. And 21 is essentially just using presentations for describing groups. So, if you have a group of order p square, you know, or I presume you know from 566 or 567, that the group must be abelian. There is a result which says, if a group modulo its center is cyclic, it must be abelian. So if you have a group of order p square, it must have a trivial, non-trivial center, either the center is the whole group, then the group is abelian, or the center has order p, that it has index p, so the factor group must be cyclic, so then again the whole group would be abelian. Okay, so for order p, we have one group. For order p square, we have two groups, namely cp cross cp and cp square. Okay. So the question is, what happens for order p cubed? And if we leave out p equals 2, I mean, 2 often behaves slightly differently. It turns out there are 2 non-isomorph, well, you have the abelian groups, of course, which you know how to describe, and there are 2 non-abelian groups of order p cubed. That means, for example, order 27 or order 125. And you can actually describe them generically. And the way to describe them, the easiest way to describe them, is as a presentation. And what this presentation does in some way really is just encoding. It's a shorter way to encode a multiplication table. You leave out the bits from the multiplication table which have to follow because you have a group. And basically, there is a hint. You know your group must have a center of order p. The center can't have order p squared, because otherwise group modulo center is cyclic, so the whole group would be abelian. So the center must have order p, and the factor group of the center can't be cyclic either, so it must be a CP cross CP. And then what you need is basically just the question, you pick 2 elements which generate the group modulo its center, and the question is, do these 2 elements generate the group or not? And that ends up in these two cases. Remark aside, one can do these classifications further. You can get a list of groups of order p to the 4, p to the 5. This has been done up to p to the 7. And, I mean, this gets more and more. The p to the 7 has been done just very, very recently, just a few years ago. And this gets more and more messy. But in some way, it is still interesting that it works, and you get more exceptions that you need to have primes bigger than 7 or primes bigger than 11 or so, but that you actually can prescribe this generically, that you can say this will hold for any arbitrary p. Okay. And there is a long-standing famous conjecture which is called the PORC conjecture, P-O-R-C. This stands for polynomial on residue classes. That conjecture by Graham Hickman, who was a famous British mathematician, said that essentially you would have, if you look at these classifications, you get case distinctions. But these case distinctions basically end up with number theoretic properties. Okay, if your prime is congruent to 3 modulo 4, or if your prime is congruent to 1 modulo 4, and so on. So that's what this on residue classes would say. That you would have a description that you might not be able to really write them down, but the total number of groups, you could write down an expression which would involve certain congruences and then polynomials in the results of these congruences. And that seems to work in small cases. The question is this really true? And at the moment, which is again a rather recent result, Marcus de Sauteuil has constructed P groups in a way where they actually come from certain parameters of elliptic curves, which you don't expect that they immediately would come in. And there he has examples which at least show the obvious assumption how people try to prove that conjecture is not true. You can't really have a proof which would split off early and then do an induction in cases. If it holds, it can only hold by a miraculous amortization argument, that you have more in one class and less in another suddenly if you go higher. So this goes far beyond, but that is, for example, a current research level problem in P groups, where no one has a good idea how to attack it. Right. The other problems are problems where I would strongly recommend that you use a computer, because otherwise you just spend pages and pages by hand, unless you want a meditation problem. So there is a bit of description how to create groups, finitely presented groups in GAP. Problem 22 is almost just to play around to get a presentation. For S5, well, I gave you already one example, the generators 1, 2, 2, 3. I probably should have said in two generators, so pick 1, 2, and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. They generate S5. And now just try out a few relations. Okay, probably A square is 1, E to the 5 is 1. Look at the order of the product. Is this already enough? And see whether that it gives you S5. What you might have to do is, if you call size on the group and GAP calculates and calculates, you might want to press Ctrl C to interrupt it, because it could be that it's infinite and it will just cry very long and eventually give. Or it, you might find, I mean, there are safety breaks built in, and at some point it will say, okay, I've tried certain things and I wasn't successful. Do you really want me to continue? 23 is to do another coset enumeration and basically to write down permutations from the coset table. Problem 24 is, there I would use the low index algorithm to find subgroups of small index. Basically, you probably would be even able to do index up to 15. And see what's the action on the cosets, and it tells you what permutation groups can be quotients of this Horvitz group. And problem 25 is, so that goes back to your question. An obvious one thing very often people start with, okay, can we show that we get a finitely presented group, someone sold it to us in a dodgy alley downtown or so, and we want to see, is this group actually finite or infinite? Okay. What can one do for, well, there is the Novikov result, which says we can't check whether the group is trivial or not, so there, but one can, as a relatively easy consequence, you cannot check whether there is no algorithmic method which is guaranteed to prove or disprove that the group is infinite. But there are basically three kinds of methods which are available to do so. One is, as in the first problem, you expose an infinite group which must be a quotient. Okay, in this first problem, this is relatively easy. That's how the problem is set up. But if you pick something like this presentation I gave you in problem 25, I don't think you can easily find matrices which are something which fulfills this. Okay. The second method is saying, well, in some way it's also looking at an infinite quotient, but a particular infinite quotient, namely an infinite abelian quotient. You do the abelian invariance. And you can apply this not just to a group, but also to a subgroup. Okay, there is a little bit I haven't yet shown you how to get the presentation of a subgroup. But you can just, if you have GAP a finitely presented group and a subgroup of finite index, you can also call abelian invariance on that subgroup. It does some magic inside. So if you find so one standard method for proving such groups infinite is you look for with a low index algorithm for subgroups of small index, and you try, do they have infinite abelian factors, quotients? And it turns out, more often than you might initially expect, this works. It doesn't work always. There are cases where it will never work because the group has a different structure, but that is actually, as a relatively cheap, quick, early heuristic, something which works quite well. The third method uses something completely different, namely, it basically tries to find a normal form for elements. That is something which is called a rewriting system, Knuth-Bendix algorithm. This is essentially a non-commutative version of Gruppner basis. And if you can show that you must have, once you have normal forms for words, you might be able to show, okay, there must be infinite normal forms. Say, if you can never move A past B, you can form a word A, B, A, B, A, B. You can make this as long as you want, and none of them can be different. Can be the same in normal. All would be normal forms, and none can be the same. same, so that would give you infinitely many elements. That's basically the three methods people are aware of, which are algorithmic for proving that a group is infinite. There are some other things which work in certain situations ad hoc, but basically that's in some way the toolbox for these cases. Okay, so that is, well, not enormously briefly, what these homework problems are about. Are there questions? No? Okay. So, what we did last time is we looked at the process of coset enumeration. That is basically taking a finitely presented group and a subgroup given by generators, and it tries to construct the permutation action on the cosets. And it does so by saying, we give the cosets, we start basically defining cosets. We call this, the first coset is a subgroup, the next coset is the subgroup times the first generator, and so on. And we do this systematically, and we we deduce equalities of cosets based on the relators and based on the fact that an element of the subgroup must be a product in the subgroup generators. That's the only kind of consequences we do. So, if this process terminates, we must have described different cosets. We never identify. We describe cosets. If the coset table closes, we have found a description which gives us a transitive permutation action. Every coset under every generator has an image, so there can't be more cosets. And the only things where we identified cosets to be the same is if they have to be because of the relators or because of the subgroup. So that must be the permutation action on the cosets. Okay. I know, I just said this. If you write this on the board, basically this is one of the theorems which you can't, unless you introduce an enormous mechanism for writing things formally, which you can't prove in a nice way apart of writing an essay. And I don't like writing essays on the board, so that's why I just said this. So if the coset, so let me at least, probably I should state this as a theorem. If the coset enumeration process terminates, that means the coset table is closed and I don't have anything open. If coset terminates, it might not terminate, for example, if you have a subgroup of infinite index, terminates, then the coset table is the permutation action on the cosets. That means in particular the number of rows is the index. Okay. Very good. The second bit, and that bit is rather subtle to formulate, and that is hard. I mean, here, in some way, the argument is not that horribly hard. It's just hard to write down. The second part is a bit more subtle, because that now really, there you need to describe an algorithm. But basically, that says, if the subgroup has finite index, and if you define your cosets systematically. Systematically means you always go through the table and you look for the first gap and define the coset. you look at the first place where a coset isn't yet defined. Okay, you need this because otherwise you could have somehow a really stupid strategy where you define cosets more and more and you never get to the situation that you actually use the relators. So, for example, if you have in your group a relator A cubed, the only way how this relator ever can get affected or can get into play is if you define, if you have some coset and you define the image of it under A and the image of that under A and the image of that under A. Otherwise, you can never follow through an A cubed. So, if you want to be mean to the algorithm, you could basically go through and look, where can I define a coset without enforcing that a relator gets hit? Right? So that's what this does. That's the reason where this comes in. If you do this, and you could do it in other ways systematically. But if you do this systematically, eventually you will be able to trace through every relator from every coset which you have defined. Okay. Then the method will terminate. Okay. So, the argument why this will terminate, and this is a little bit vague how I formulate it, because to prove it here, you again need to introduce something. You need to talk, be able not just to talk about the group, but to talk about the process of coset enumeration. But basically what is happening, if you do this systematically, you will be able to trace through every... Okay, sorry, let me say this. If two cosets are identical, right? Then you can write down the fact that they are identical. This must follow from some word in the relators or conjugates of the relators and the subgroup generators. That's eventually what means that they are the same. The quotient of the coset representatives must lie in the subgroup, so you can write this as a product in the subgroup generators, but you might also have to involve the relators. But if there was an omniscient being which was doing this process, this being could write down this identity, and in the end, this would be a finite expression in the letters. It could be horrible, but it is a finite expression. Well, if you do this process systematically, eventually you will hit that finite expression in the letters. And you will be able to trace it through in your other, well, in the other tables, using the things which you have defined. And therefore, you will get this equality of the cosets eventually. Okay. So, if it has finite index, there are finitely many cosets. You define different cosets, but eventually, some which you defined, which actually, that can happen in the process. You define cosets, but they are actually the same. You define them initially as different, but they are the same, and I'll talk about that in a moment, what we do there. You will find that they have to be the same. So eventually you get all these identities, and that shows you that eventually it terminates. Okay. The thing where one has to be rather careful, and that's why I said the method will terminate, and that comes with this result of Kuhn-Novikov. You just know at some point it will terminate in finite time, but there is no bound on the time based on the size of the input. And therefore it is not an algorithm. Because if you let this run for a while, you do not know, do I need to, and it hasn't terminated, do I need to let it run longer and it will terminate, or it will never terminate because it has infinite index or something? So that's the subtlety here, where one needs to be slightly careful in formulating this result. Okay. And in practice, I mean, if the index is up to a few hundred thousand or so, it actually behaves reasonably well. It behaves better than one might initially assume on something which goes through so naively. Okay. So, I did a small example last time, but that was almost so small that some things become trivial. So I thought I'll do a slightly longer example to show what is happening there. So, what I'm taking here is, and then once I've done this example, I'll tell you what happens in this coincidence situation, which I didn't yet talk about. Well, so my group is the group generated by A and B, so that A squared is equal to B cubed is AB to the 5 is the identity. So I have told you that group is A5. We haven't proven that it is A5. And the subgroup I'm taking is the subgroup generated by A and A to the B. Okay. And I think what index will I get? I'm getting index 6 there, so this would be a subgroup of order 10. So basically, this is a dihedral group of order 10. The symmetries of a five gon. Okay. Right. So, what I do is I create coset. Again, I create the tables. I have the coset table, and I have related tables and subgroup tables. Okay. So the coset table has, well, I know if it has at least one coset. I have A inverse, B, and B inverse. And that enumeration is also in these notes on computational group theory. So that's in part why I'm doing this example. You don't need to copy the process, but you have a written version of the process there. Okay. And what tables do I have? I have relator tables. I have a relator table for A squared. I have a relator table for B cubed. I have a relator table for A, B, A, B, A, B, A, B, A, B. And I have subgroup tables for A and a subgroup table for B inverse AB. Okay, and the subgroup tables just have one row. The relator tables will have as many rows as the coset table. And if you would implement this, you actually would only store the coset table, and you would deal with these tables ad hoc by just tracing things through from start and end. Okay. So, because I have A as a generator, I get immediately a consequence here that the image of A, 1 under A, has to be 1. So I actually start with a consequence. I know the image of A has to be 1. That means the image of 1 under A inverse also has to be 1. So I can trace through the 1 here. Well, this consequence doesn't give me anything new. The image of 1 under A is 1, and I haven't yet done anything with B. So that's the tables. Right. Now I need to define, and I will go through systematically. So I define this as 2, right? So the coset number 2 shall be the coset of the subgroup with representative B. Okay. So, I have a coset 2, and I know the image of 1 under B is 2. I know that the image of 2 under B inverse is 1. So here I can also put a 1. 1 under B is 2. 1 under B inverse I don't know. Yeah, the rest I don't yet know. Okay. Right. So. Oh, and yeah, sorry. Here I have a. Oh yeah, I have 2 here as well, and 1 under B is 2, and 1 under A is 1, so I can fill this back already that far. Okay.
I'm sorry, real quick, just, you have that 2, the B,
this
B's, and it has, you have the 2 there, how do you know that that's a 2?
Because 2 under B inverse is 1, that this is a 2.
Uh-huh.
Because these are relator tables.
Oh, so there's...
Okay. The relators are the identity in the group.
They always have.
So if I take the coset number 2 and I multiply with BBB, I'm multiplying with the identity. Mm-hmm. That must be the same coset. That's why I know that this must be a 2.
Just like that.
One yeah.
Also have a 2.
Okay, now, and this, sorry, and this also has a 2, and I'm sure. Yeah. What will happen is that I will miss numbers.
Right, okay, cool.
There. Okay. Next, I define this as B inverse, as the image under B inverse. So I have a coset 3, and that coset. What does this do? Oh, that's okay. So 3 under B is 1. I don't know anything with 3 here. 3 under B is 1, right? 1 under B is 2, so I get a consequence here. I get the consequence 2 under B, so let's for the moment write this in a piece of scrap bag, blackboard, 2 under B is 3. That is one consequence I'm getting there. 3 under A, I don't know. I don't know what under what. Well, 3 under B inverse I also don't know, so I can't fill things in further here. What under 3 under B is 1, so I can fill in that 3 here. I can similarly fill in the three here, and I can fill in now 1 under B inverse is 3. Something under B is 1, 3 under B is 1, so I get the other consequence, 3 under A is 3. Okay? And I filled the subgroup table. So from now on, the subgroup tables are completely full. I'm going to ignore them. I don't need to do with anything with them anymore. So I get consequences. 2 under B has to be 3. So 2 under B is 3, so 3 under B inverse is 2. And I get the consequence 3 under A is 3, so 3 under A inverse is also 3. Okay, right, so let's fill these in. 3 under A is 3. I get a consequence 3 under A is 3, but that I know already. 2 under B is 3. So I get a consequence 3 under B is 1, but I know this. Oh, sorry, I would have gotten that also here. And similarly here I get 2 under B is 3. I could have backfilled the 1 actually here, so these I know. Okay. 2 under A I don't know, but okay. So 3 under A inverse is 3. 3 under B inverse is 2. What 2 and A is, I don't know, so I can't fill back here, I can't fill forward here. Indeed, I mean, there is a certain repetition in the pattern because the relator is periodic, and one could actually save a little bit of work. 3 under A, I know, is 3. 3 under B is 1, 1 under A is 1, 1 under B is
2,
so I get 2 under, is that correct? 2 under A is 2, is that correct?
I think you've got a diagonal happening.
Thank you.
Those three should be upper row.
Oh, yeah, right. Thank you. Okay, because that looked a little bit. So let's go back here. So 3 under A inverse is 3. 3 under B inverse is 1, right? No, 3 under B inverse is 2. I don't know what A does with 2. I don't know what A does with 2. So I can't do anything more. And this relator here, 3 under B is 1. 1 under A is 1. 1 under B is 2. I don't know what 2 does with A. 3 under B inverse is 2. 2 under, I don't know what 2 under A inverse does. So that's... Now, I define my next coset number 4. Okay, so coset number that will be coset number 4. So I have 4 and 4 under A inverse, therefore is 2. Okay, so 4 under A, I don't know, but I know 4 under A inverse is 2, so I know that 4 under A has to be 2, so I also must have 2 here, and vice versa, I must have 2 under A is 4, so 4 under A is 2, and vice versa. Okay, I get these two consequences, and that's just A square is the identity. So I wouldn't really need the A inverse column. Okay, 4 and B, I have no idea what it does. Okay, 2 under A is 4, I had defined this. 2 under A inverse is also 4. But I don't know what 4 and B does, so I can't yet fill. Simply I get 4, 4 here, and I get 4, 4 here. 4 under A is 2, 2 under B is 3, 3 under A is 3, 3 under B is 1, 1 under A is 1, 1 under B is 2, 2 under A is 4, 4 under B I don't know, 4 under B inverse I also don't know. Okay. So I have all the consequences which come. Right, so my next open hole is here. 4 under B is 5. So, not 5 here. 5 under B inverse is 4. 5 doesn't know yet anything with A, so I can't fill in here. But I know that 4 under B is 5, and 4 under B inverse I don't yet know. 5 under B inverse is 4. Okay? And I don't know what 5 does with A. 5 under B inverse is 4. 4 under A inverse is 2. 2 under B inverse is 1. 1 under A inverse is 1, 1 under B inverse is 3, 3 under A inverse is 3, 3 under B inverse is 2, 2 under A inverse is 4. I don't yet know what 4 under B inverse is. Okay, so next definition, I define 4 under B inverse is 6. Okay. So I have 6 under B therefore is 4. So 5 under. Okay, I have 6 here. Okay. 6 under B inverse is 4. Under. I don't know this. 6 under B is also. No, 6. Sorry, I don't know what 6 is under B inverse. Sorry. 6 under B is 4. 4 under B is 5. So I get as consequence that 5 under B has to be 6. Okay. Here, 4 under B. Oh, I hadn't filled in the 5 here. Sorry. 4 under B is 5. Yeah. 4 under B is 5. So, and that's in some way always the same because it's a periodic relator. I have one hole here. Okay. But I now can go back here. 4 under B inverse is 6. Right? And I can. 4 under B inverse is 6, and 4 under B I had said was 5. So I can put the 6 here, I can put the 6 here. And I get always the same relay consequence everywhere here. I get that 5 under A has to be 6. Okay.
And we also get all those relations in the coset table as well, right?
Yep. Yes, and now I just, to do it systematically, now these were immediately the consequences. Let's write these in the coset table. So if you implement this, you basically have some kind of stack of consequences which you need to, of identities which you need to process through. So 5 under A is 6, therefore 6 under A inverse is 5. 5 under A is 6, so 6 under A is also 5 and 6 here. Okay, and I don't write these separate, that is so obvious. Okay, 5 under, yeah, and that table is full, and of course I have also row 6 here. And row 6 will now, because this is basically, will also trace through completely. I don't get a new consequence there, because it's a periodic relator. You can just shift this around to have 6 at the start. Right, you take this away and can cycle it around a few steps, and then you see you get the same sequence. 6, 4, 2, 3, 3, 1, these ones are the same ones. 1, 2, 4, 5. Okay.
We also got that 6 under 4, or 6.
Yeah, and we had 6 under 5 under B is 6, so I get also a 6 here, and 6 under B inverse is 5. Okay. And now my coset table is closed. I don't have any image which is open, or I don't know what the image would be. So my coset table is closed. I have processed all the consequences which I had. Didn't get any, well, it might be that you get some further consequences which we knew already, if you fill in these numbers here. But I didn't get any new consequences which really gave me a new identity. So the table is closed. That's the action on the cosets. And so I get the permutations. A must be mapped to the permutation given in this column. 1 is mapped to 4. One is mapped to 1, sorry. 2 is mapped to 4, and 4 is mapped to 2. And 5 and 6 are swapped. And B is mapped to the permutation. 1 is mapped to 2, is mapped to 3, is mapped back to 1. And 4 is mapped to 5, is mapped to 6, is mapped back to 4. So these two permutations are the action on the cosets, and you can verify easily that they fulfill these relations. And these two, yes, it's on 6 points, it's not on 5 points, but it's an action of A5 on 6 points. Okay, right. So that is another example of such a coset operation. Now there is one thing which could happen, which I did not happen have happened in this example to not make it more messy. Namely, here all the consequences were consequences which filled out holes. It could be that I get a consequence, let's say I would have gotten a consequence which would not fill a hole, but which would contradict what I have written there. Right? I could have defined the image of 1 under B is 2, and later I get a consequence, the image of 1 under B is 1. Could have happened. Okay. What does this mean? Because I'm only taking consequences which have to hold in the group. This means coset number 1 and coset number 2 have to be the same. So these are things which are also consequences, but consequences which tell me certain cosets have to be the same. Okay. So some of these consequences could tell me certain cosets which I had initially defined, where I initially had assumed they are different cosets, actually are the same coset. Well, what do I do in this case? I identify the cosets. I could in this case say leave out row 2, then I know that row 2 must be the same as row 1. But that will give me further identities, right? If row 2 is the same as row 1, then 4 would have to be the same as 1, and 2 would have to be 2, which anyhow I knew was the same as 1, would have to be the same as 3, and so on. So once I identify cosets, I get further identities. I need to process these identities, and these can give me further consequences. So actually what I need to do there is to have essentially a stack where I put the consequences, where I put these identities in, and I process through this stack, and I can get further. Once, while I'm doing this, I can get further identities, which I need put also on the stack or on a queue, or whatever data structure, it doesn't matter in which order you do it. And you can, and that is typically what happens in larger coset enumerations, that you get a whole, in the end, once just before you're done with the table, you get a whole avalanche of such identities and identifying cosets. Okay. That makes even more than just the tediousness of filling this out. This is a really annoying process to do on paper, because what you basically have to do is you potentially need to erase numbers and replace them with others once you have the consequences, and you need to keep track of this and do this systematically. Okay.
Quick question. You said, if we found out that 1 is equal to 2,
yeah,
then that consequence would also say that 1 is equal to 4.
Yes.
And then it goes
as a further consequence. And then 1 being equal to 4 would tell us that 2 has to be equal to 5 and so on.
Great.
Yeah, so, I mean, in this case, if you had this consequence, actually everything will collapse, because if the image of 1 under B is also 1, basically you must have the trivial permutation action. And to do that in an example where... We could have taken a subgroup which gives us the whole group, but not in an obvious way that it would happen. But this gets very quickly quite messy, and I frankly don't trust myself enough to do this really clearly and systematically without making a mistake. It's something which isn't that horribly hard to teach to a computer. Really, the only difficulty is you need to, well, do things systematically. You have to have in some way two kinds of queues. On the one hand, to make sure you process all the consequences, and you need to have this queue which processes the identities and does this. And if you do the identities, some numbers vanish, so you actually might want to renumber your cosets that you don't have holes. And that is not hard, but not a pleasure to do by hand. Okay. Yes, and this, as I mentioned before, was one of the earliest algorithms which was implemented for abstract algebra simply because it is so horrible to do by hand, and on the other hand, is actually not that enormously hard to describe on a computer, and that is a standard tool for working if you really want to know something concretely about these presentations. Of course, it only works for finite index, and of course, it only works, you have this weird termination criteria. If you see how you get the consequences, you will also, in this case, it didn't really matter that much, but you can notice that sometimes you have a gap, just a single number gap there. So in this case, actually, it would be convenient to make a definition which will fill the row. And there are other strategies for enumerating it, which work much, often in practice work better, in actually trying deliberately to get consequences quickly. So that process is coset enumeration. It gives us the permutation action on the cosets of a finite subgroup, and if the subgroup has finite index, eventually it will terminate. But yeah, it can take a while. Yeah. So. If you want to see an example of coincidences, I have in these notes in the next section an example where the coset definitions were done slightly differently, in a more unsystematic way. And initially, six cosets were defined where the table wasn't closed. And then I give an example what happens with these coincidences. I really don't want to do this on the board because processing it will involve erasing things and replacing numbers, and I know that that will end up in disaster. But if you want to have something spelled out in an example, it is printed there. Okay. So, what I want to do next is, I mentioned already there is this low index algorithm, and sometimes people describe it as a variant of coset enumeration. That they say, actually what we are doing is we are looking at possible permutation representations, but we're looking at possible coset tables. In some way that is really the same. For some reason in the literature, people talked about coset tables and did not really talk about permutation representations. And I think that is that when people initially started working with it on a computer, they did not have machinery for working with permutation groups. But I think actually the best way of looking at it is to take the coset tables just as a tool in computing the permutation representation, and rather look at it as the permutation representation and work with a homomorphism. In general, if you do have something in mathematics, if you can describe something with functions, or if you have something and you can describe it as a homomorphism, that's a nicer thing than some weird table with numbers. Okay. So, the other thing I want to do now is, and I will probably not get to complete this all this week, is to look at one other process which one can do in the context of such coset tables. Okay. Namely, if you have the coset table for a subgroup and it is finite, I can write a presentation for the subgroup. I can take the presentation for the group and, using the coset table, build a presentation for the subgroup. Okay. That is in some way not that surprising. Basically, What I know is I know what the generators for the subgroup are. And I know what else do I want to do there. I know basically in the process of the coset enumeration I got consequences, and these consequences came for certain reasons, and I could keep track what these reasons would be. Right. So. What I should say is some of this there is very much related to topology, and some of these things you can prove in a rather different way using topology. Basically there you have a situation of a duality of something like the Galois correspondence, that you can have spaces and covering spaces, and the covering spaces will correspond to subgroups of your fundamental group. And what I'm doing, if I'm getting a presentation for the subgroup, I can I could interpret as building, looking at what happens with the covering, what is the fundamental group of the covering space. I will not do this, but I will basically give a combinatorial description here. But I should mention that, and you will often find this in books, that they go the topological route. And one main result there, which we will get to, is the theorem of Nielsen and Schreier, which says that any subgroup of a free group is free. Okay, I will just be able to prove it for the finite index case. The topological proof is nice in the sense of that it doesn't require finite index. I need finite index because I'm looking at these coset tables. But essentially what I want to do is I want to describe a generic way. If I have a coset table or I have a permutation representation on the cosets of some subgroup, how I can describe generators for this subgroup. Okay, if I started with generators, I have already some. But I can actually get generically generators for this subgroup and how I can write relators in these generators. And that way, construct the presentation for the subgroup. And that is indeed what in this last homework problem I'm giving you, what gap internally does. You have a subgroup, it will internally construct a presentation for the subgroup, and then that is also in a finitely presented group in its own, and you can do things with that. And you could iterate the process. The only price you're paying is essentially that when you go to subgroups, your presentations for the subgroups gets more and more messy. So this has just a limited scope in how far one can go. So what I want to start with is actually to look at particular generators for a subgroup of finite index. And that doesn't really need anything about finitely presented groups, but I need to do this to actually describe these generators. And I will pick these other generators because in the behavior with these, with respect to these other generators is nicer. If I want to pick a particular set of generators, things get slightly more complicated. Okay. So, what I will do, and that should fit in nicely, is to look at the following lemma, which is due to Schreier. Okay. And that lemma basically describes subgroup generators, if you have group generators, and a description of the cosets. So, where this lemma also applies is if you want to calculate the stabilizer of some object, if a group is acting on some set and you want to calculate the stabilizer of a point, by calculating the images of the set of this point, you get the orbit. The orbit is in bijection with the cosets of the stabilizer. So you have a description of the cosets. And from that, one can construct a set of generators for the subgroup, which in that case is the stabilizer. And these generators are called Schreier generators. So, start. So, I have a group which is generated by finitely many elements. Let G be a group generated by a set of generators. G, and I will use this underlined to indicate that this is a set of generators. And I have that S is a subgroup of G, which has finite index. Okay. And I have a set of representatives for the cosets. So let R, which consists of R1 up to Rn, is set of coset representatives. And I want that R1 is the identity, just for convenience purposes, that I'm using the identity element to represent the trivial coset. Okay. So, what would my coset representatives be in this case of coset enumeration? It would be the words where I defined, right? Sometimes I picked a new number. I picked the number 2 here, the number 3 here, the number 4 here, the number 5 here, and the number 6 there for the first time. So the representative for the trivial coset is 1. The representative for the coset 2 is B. The representative for the coset 3 is B inverse. The representative for the coset 4 is 4 is defined as 2A, so that will be B times A. 5 is defined as the image of 4 under B, so the representative there will be BAB and BAB inverse. Okay? So these would be the representatives. And if I have a coset table, by looking at the first occurrence, I could pick such representatives. Okay. Right. And for an element H in G, let H upper bar be one of an element, one coset representative Ri, where SH is equal to SH bar, which is SRi. So the upper bar notation means pick the representative for the coset which I have in my set of representatives. So, for example, if I took the word B square, right? B square would map 1 to 2 to 3. I would have the word B square, but the representative I have for B is B inverse. So B square upper bar would be B inverse. That's some kind of normal form word. And if I'm taking an orbit algorithm and images there, well, then I just look at what word gave me the image, this image in the orbit for the first time. Okay. And now Schreier's theorem says he looks at a particular set. Let U be the set of all elements of the following form. I'm taking any coset representative and multiplying the coset representative with an arbitrary generator. Okay. I have n coset representatives, I have m generators, so I have n times m many such elements. Okay. That will give me just something in the group. Okay. But this product will lie in some coset. So I take the representative of the corresponding coset, Rigj bar, and I divide that off. So I get an element, I take the coset representative for the coset which contains that element, and I divide that coset representative off. That must lie in the subgroup. So clearly this will give me elements in the subgroup. And I pick all I goes from 1 to n, and j goes from 1 to m. Let's say this is generated by g bar up to gm. Okay, and the theorem says then S is generated by this set U. And these generators are called Schreier generators. Okay. So, for example, just in this case, just to give you an example of one of these generators, let's say R, the representative for coset 2, is B. Let's say the generator G, J, I'm also picking B. Okay. Do I want to do this? Well, yeah, why not? Well, and then I have the product R2 times GJ is, of course, B squared. What is the representative for the coset B squared? Well, that's the coset number 3. So I have that R2 times GJ bar is the representative R3, and that is B inverse. Okay? So, what I need to form is the Schreier generator would be dB square divided by B inverse, which is B cubed. Okay. In the finitely presented group, of course, B cubed was a relator, that is trivial. But if I do this systematically, or if I would go back in the free group, that would not necessarily hold. So in the free group, this would be a non-trivial element. Yeah. So a lot, if you have a finite group, a lot of these generators will be trivial. But if you have a subgroup of a free group of finite index, very, very few of these will be trivial. Okay. So, and if you look at this in the situation of of calculating the stabilizer of a set or of a point, what are you doing there? Ri basically would say, okay, you take some image of this point which you have already. You take any point, map it under every generator. You anyhow have to do this to find the orbit. You take the image under any generator. You look, what do you get? If it is new, you take it new. If it is old, you had already a word which gave you that image. You divide off that word that, no, this will map the original point back to the original point, must lie in the stabilizer. And what this theorem of this lemma says is, indeed, these elements together generate the stabilizer. Okay. And it will turn out that in these particular generators, we can give relations for the subgroup in a nice way. That's why I'm picking these generators here. Okay. The other reason why I'm doing this is that in the proof of this lemma, it actually gives does a certain process which is basically processing a word. This is often called rewriting. We take a word and we write it in other generators, or we put things in a certain way together and say these are shall be other elements of the group. And we do this in a systematic way that we actually write that we have an arbitrary word in the group generators where we know it happens to lie in the subgroup and we write it in these generators. Yeah, this process is called rewriting, and that is one standard technique for working with finitely presented groups. So let's prove this. And the proof is not... Once you realize what you do, it's a proof which almost can run on autopilot. You just have to be careful to get the indices correctly. So, I take an element in the group. An element which should lie in this subgroup S. And S is a subgroup of G. So I can write S as a word in the generators. Well, because I have generators, right? Then S is a word GI1 times GI2 times and so forth times GI. Okay. As a word in the generators.
Are little x and little s the
same? Oh, a little x is, little. Probably, why did I call it x? Let's call it little s. There is no reason to call it x. Okay. S word and now what I want to do is I want to pick I will pick coset, choose certain coset representatives, and I will change this word that it gives me the same element, but that in the end it's a word in such expressions. Okay. So, what I'm doing is I'm inserting an identity, namely I'm inserting an identity which is the representative for the trivial coset. So I insert an element T1 where T1 is the representative for the coset 1 and is the identity. The T's will be coset representatives. I just call them T something and not R something, so I don't need to double index. If I called them R, I would have to have R, J something, J1, J2, and so forth, and I would just want to call them T1, T2. So, choose coset representatives T1 and so forth, which all should be in the set of coset representatives. Okay. Right, so I have this. I've just added a 1, well, that doesn't do much. Okay. And now I'm inserting an identity element. That is one of the standard things you do in group theory. You can insert an identity anywhere in a word. Then identity you write as a quotient of an element by itself. So what do I quotient? What do I quotient here? I insert, and again, this is spelled out in these notes of computational group theory. That's why I dare to write it so sloppy, because there you can find a nice typeset version. What I'm picking is, I have T1 times GI1. That must lie in some coset. And that coset will have a canonical representative. So I take this element, and I take its inverse in the element itself, T1 times GI1 bar. Okay, so what do I have? I have that S is equal to T1 GI1, T1 GI1 bar inverse. T1 GI1 bar times G2 and so forth. Okay. And now the observation is, this is a Schreier generator, right? It's a coset representative times a generator divided off the canonical representative for that product. Okay. And this thing here, the T1 G1 bar, is a representative for a coset chosen from my representative set. So this element I will now call T2. Okay. And what I will do is exactly the same game again. Here, before I continue with G3, I will insert the corresponding quotient. So I take T2 G2 bar inverse times T2 G2 bar. That is an identity. And I have G3. Okay. And then I can observe that I have here T2 times G2 times T2 G2 bar inverse. So that will be my next coset, and my next Schreier generator, and so on. Okay, so that's the process. And this is called rewriting, because I have a word, I keep the same element, but I just readjust letters or insert things where I know that is the identity, and then associate them together differently, that I can express it somehow differently. Okay, so, and I continue that process. So the only extra thing I need to do is, and I mean, I won't write you the next steps. I think now it's pretty clear what is happening. The only thing where I have to be slightly careful is at what happens at the end. Right? So, what happens at the very end? So, if I do this, ... and I get some Schreier generator. So these are all elements which are Schreier generator. At the very end, my word, I had said I had k letters. So I will end with
tk minus 1.
I get tk minus 1. Times G by K. TK minus 1, yeah, right? That's what I have there at the very end. That's when I can't immediately continue the process. Okay, because if I did this, yes, I could insert an identity at the end, but then I would have... Or let's do this. What would... Yeah, so this is basically where something interesting is happening. So what is the interesting thing that will be happening? I will insert TK plus 1 GIK bar inverse times TK plus 1 GIK bar. Right? Okay. But when I do this now, I don't have further generators, so I would have something left standing here where I don't know how to process it. Okay. So, to deal with this, what are actually in this element, if I would continue, I would call this element, not, wait, did I write plus one? I had minus, sorry, but minus, it was plus. For no good reason, k minus 1.
Is it not t? Would it not be tk? Because we call
that element would be now be I this canonical representative I would call tk.
I think
am I off with the index?
Well, I'm just
oh, I have t1 before g1. Yeah, sorry.
Because we have
then
t2,
this
t2,
is,
t2,
sorry,
t2.
This is tk, yeah. And then I could actually do k plus x.
Yeah, we call
you.
That tk. Yeah.
Yeah, we call that tk, and then this is tk plus. No, this is still tk, sorry. This is all tk, and then we would call this tk plus 1. Right? Okay?
Then don't we have gik plus
1? No. The t number is always the number of the following gi.
Technically, that tk should
yeah.
be.
Yeah.
It's the same
because I called, that probably should have called this t0 and not t1.
Okay.
Yeah?
Great.
That's basically, since my t start with 1, I need plus 1 here. Yeah. Okay. So, that would still be nice. This would be this is again an element in U. Right? So, what can I tell about this is in the way? Right. So, how do I deal with this? Well, what are the TIs? If you look at this process, how we actually define the TIs, you find that TI is the coset, the canonical representative for the product GI1. No, I is not a good index. TJ is the representative for the product GI1 up to GI J minus 1 canonical representative. Why is this the case? Well, T1 is the representative for the empty word, yes, for the trivial coset. What happens with T2? Well, I have T2 is the representative, okay, that I have T1 GI1. Okay, T1 was trivial. T1 GI1 therefore is just the representative for the word GI1. So that holds. What happens in the next step? For that you can ignore what as far as canonical representatives do. These elements, these Schreier generators, clearly lie in the subgroup. So they will not change the coset. So for as far as the coset is concerned, actually, the coset of this expression, if I go up to G3, the coset with this representative is the same as the coset with this representative, is the same as the coset with this representative. Right? And what is the representative there? I have T2. T2 was T1... GI1, okay, if I have cosets, if I have canonical representatives before, will not change the cosets. So that would be the coset with representative GI1. Oh, this is not G2, but GI2. Sorry, GI2, GI3. Yeah. Okay, so that proves this property. So what does this have to be? TK plus 1, therefore, is the representative for the coset GI1 up to GIK. And that's the representative for the coset with S, but S was in the subgroup. I haven't used that fact so far. But otherwise, it clearly doesn't hold. So now I'm using the fact that S is in the subgroup, and that means it needs to be the representative for the trivial coset. And I had chosen it that this is the identity element. And that's why I want to choose it, that it's the identity element. Okay, so that doesn't do any harm. That's the identity element. I can just leave it out. And now I have rewritten my word in the triad generators. Last remark. Technically, I would need to allow inverses here. Okay. It goes through exactly the same way, and then you need to deal with inverses. And then it's just messy. And similarly, here I actually would need to allow not just generators, but inverses of generators. If the group is finite, that doesn't really matter. Sorry. Yes, so I need to actually allow plus minus one. If I have a finite group, G, that doesn't matter, but in general I need to allow the inverses. Or if I know that the generators are finite order, but I need to allow the inverses to deal with inverses. Okay, right, so that proves this lemma about generators. And what I will do next time then is to show you a process how one can write relators, defining relators in these triad generators. And that gives you a way to start with a presentation for a group and get a presentation for the subgroup. Okay, thank you very much. So that will be only on the 21st because I am out of town the next 2 weeks. Thank you very much.